Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runner, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by Ironman U, by EveryCite.com, the coolest new technology around. RunCatalina.com. We got the Catalina Marathon coming up on Saturday, March 19th. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation, where we've raised over $70 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. And check out any of our interviews on iTunes or on Babbittville, and make sure that you subscribe to our new newsletter, Endurance World. Our next guest, one of the premier coaches in all of swimming, Mr. Jerry Rodriguez, joins us. Jerry, how are you?
I'm good, sir. How are you? Thank you for having me.
I'm wonderful. What I read a little bit about your bio is you were into swimming from an early age in the beautiful country of Trinidad. I'm imagining that with the access to open water that you were in the ocean pretty young.
You know, it's interesting. We uniquely, actually, because many Caribbean islands didn't have a ton of open water swimming, and Trinidad was the first to have an open water race. And from the time I was 9 years old, our coach took us to the beach.
Yeah.
Three to four times a week, 4 months a year, to prepare us for that race. So from I left Trinidad when I was 16. From 9 through 16, whatever that is, 6, 7 years.
Yeah.
A third of my swimming was done in open water.
And from then, did you win that race?
So we didn't get to race it, but you had to be 16 to get in at that time. And what they did with their group of kids like myself, that were sort of the upcoming blossomers, and they finally lowered the age to 12. So a whole group of us went in that first that year, a bunch of 12 and 13-year-olds and 14-year-olds. And I was third as a 12-year-old, and then I won it multiple times after.
I thought so. And was the open water more appealing to you than being in the pool from a young age?
You know, there was a sense of, I don't know if it was more appealing. There was just a different element, a different environment. I really enjoyed it. I sort of enjoyed the freedom of it. And I was able to have this sort of, whether it's learned or innate intuitiveness on how to train and race better in it. And subsequently always performed way beyond my pool talents, which were not that good, actually, in open water. I was able to swim with the best swimmers in the world and race them in open water, but wasn't so good in pool races.
That must have driven some people crazy when they're swimming with you in a pool, kicking your butt, and then you get in open water, and they're like, wait a second, why is that guy on a beach in front of me?
Well, you know, it probably is no different than a 10K runner on the track that can run 26:30 to 27 minutes. I think the world record is somewhere in 26:20s now. But so anyone that's under 27 minutes on the track is pretty darn fast, right?
Right, yep.
A 30-minute guy on the track, it's good, but it's not that good, right, compared to the 26:30 guy. And so I was sort of the 30-minute guy on the track. But when we got into open water, I was right next to the 26:30 guy.
I love that.
So the world changed a little bit and gave me a little more confidence and so on.
Yeah, and because a lot of times the guys in the pool, hey, water's always the same temperature, you got lane lines, it's pretty simple. You get in the ocean, you've got current, kelp, someone hitting you in your head. It's almost the difference between when you have a horse race and the track is dry, and then you've got, you know, the track gets muddy from the rain. It's a, you know, opens everything up, right? It's a different game.
A lot of variables. I mean, no different than a draft legal triathlon race versus a non-draft race.
Yep.
Once you get into that draft legal deal, you know, some people are very comfortable in it, others aren't.
Love that. So, and the other thing that I found interesting is 1972, Mark Spitz is going for 7 gold medals in Munich, and you're the kid who's setting your alarm at 3 a.m., to get up and listen to the radio call of Mark Spitz. So you were that guy, right? You were the guy that's like, I'm going to be getting that gold medal just like Mark Spitz.
You know, Bob, I was, I think, a total little swimming nerd that just happened to be I think one of those people that was just born to do what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And begged my dad to take me swimming from the time I was 3 or 4 years old, at least according to him. And finally, you know, after he gave in after a few years, and at 7, took me in and took me to my first swim session. And by the way, I was the last kid to learn how to swim. The whole group that I joined with, they all moved on to the next class, and I didn't pass. I had to retake it. I wasn't very good, but I loved what I was doing, and I remember setting that alarm. I started reading the magazines on swimming. My dad would buy them from the U.S. Swimming World magazine that I ended up becoming the publisher of, and he gave me those opportunities, so I was so into swimming that I'd set that alarm early and wake up and listen to actually live broadcast from Munich is what it was. And I just, man, there he is again winning. All right, I want to be like that guy one day.
A lot of guys get that black line fever. They start when they're young and they burn out and they go away. It sounds like no matter what the volume was you were given, you were, give me more.
You know, I think I was just, like I said, one of those lucky few that were born to do what we're doing.
Yeah.
And I think when someone gets that from a young age or has opportunity for it like I did at a young age, we're just the fortunate few in the world. Not necessarily few, but it's just a wonderful thing. And whether it was volume or intensity or environment, I just loved who I did it with. I enjoyed all my coaches. I was a student of the sport.
So when you come to the U.S., was that when you got your swim scholarship to Pepperdine?
You know, so back then, this is such a long time ago because I'm in my 50s. Trinidad was on the British educational system.
Yep.
So our high school, you finished high school typically at 17, and if you were in the young end, if you started early, you'd finish at 16. So I finished high school 3 months after, or 4 months after I turned 16. And I had taken the Cambridge exams, which is what we took from the University of Cambridge. And once I got those certificates, I started actually the first year of college in Trinidad. And then by that time, I got accepted into a junior college because I wasn't good enough to get an athletic scholarship. So I went to junior college in Mission Viejo for a year and a half and then transferred in under a scholarship to Pepperdine, which is a decent swimming school, but not any great swimming school. I mean, I wasn't good enough to make it to the good swim schools, to UCLA or USC I was an okay swimmer. I wasn't that good.
So when did you move into coaching and realize that, you know what, I love to swim, but coaching is really something that moves me?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The last year that I was finishing my competitive season at Pepperdine, 1983, a group of us, a handful of us, and you might even know one of them. I don't know if you know Kevin Steele.
Oh, yeah, very well, from 24 Hour Fitness.
Exactly. So Kevin and I and Barry Devine and a group of others started one of the first triathlon clubs in Los Angeles, Team Malibu.
Oh, that's right, yes. Yep.
And I was their coach.
Well, that's when the Malibu Triathlon started around 1982 or 1983.
Exactly. I was the default swim coach, and we went to help Michael Epstein at his race. It was either his first year or second year. We were the volunteers for that event.
Love that. And now, when you saw this whole triathlon thing starting, because usually people are coming into this back then, with a running background, or, you know, either a run or swim, and very few of us had bike background.
That's right. Yeah.
But a lot of the folks had no swim background. The runners, you know, your legs sink, you're pretty pathetic. Did you see an opportunity there that, man, these guys, they need some help here?
You know, I don't think I was entrepreneurially that smart at that time. And I just saw, I liked the sport.
Yep.
I enjoyed the ambiance of it. I liked that people wanted to be the best that they could be. It didn't matter to me what level they were. If they were a beginner or, you know, we had very good swimmers that came in to triathlon. Paul Donahue, you might remember him, who passed away.
Very well, yeah.
And so for me, it was more about teaching these folks to to become better at the craft that I knew, and really to become good in open water, because that's where the non-swimmer, who didn't have the background, could actually make up on the swimmer. Because, you know, those 26, 30, 10K runners on the track, if they couldn't convert as well into an open race, many do in running, so it may not have been a perfect example. But when the 30-minute runner on the track, he has no business being at the start line with the 26, 30 guy. Just has no business. Doesn't even deserve being there. Not good enough. But in an open race, such as in an open water, we can mitigate out a lot of those fast swimmers with teaching the non-fast swimmers and non-experienced swimmers or triathletes certain skills, certain training protocols. So, and that's what I did.
When did it become a business for you? When did you become, you know, basically a professional coach?
Immediately after college.
Oh, so right away. Yeah.
Oh, immediately in 83, I started coaching while finishing my last, I had a few months left of school after my year of final eligibility. And began coaching, went into the business world for a while, wore the suit and tie for a number of years, but was always coaching. In fact, never stopped from 1983.
Love that. And now we mentioned Mark Spitz earlier. When he came out of retirement and tried to make an Olympic team again, did you coach him?
Not at that time. Mark came out of retirement in 1990, I believe.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Trying to make the 92 team.
Right.
I think is what it was, 20 years after 72. And when I started, when I launched the swimming program at UCLA, which was in 1995, that was a couple of years later.
Yep.
Mark lived in Beverly Hills, or still does, and joined our program, and I've known him a few years before.
How cool was that Mark Spitz was swimming in your program?
Oh, it was, you know, and those who know Mark Spitz would sort of chuckle, because Mark is one of these guys that he will duck out of any workout and try to cut intervals as much as he can. He'd try to make any deal he can to cut the workload.
Looking for the shortcut.
It's interesting. It's not so much he looked for shortcuts. He was just a guy that just loved to race.
Right.
He would just make deals up. Okay, Jerry, if I swim whatever time, 28 seconds right now for the 50 butterfly, could the whole team get out? Can we just all go home? Can we just all go out there somewhere?
So for him, it was a social thing.
Yes, it was.
I mean, think about it. He's won 7 gold medals. He doesn't have a lot to prove.
He won 7 gold medals in 72, two in 68. He had 9 gold medals, silver, bronze. I mean, he was certainly decorated. And, you know, at that time, the most decorated Olympic athlete.
When I look at the best innovations in triathlon in terms of getting new people into the sport, I don't think anything has had the impact that the wetsuit has, the swimming wetsuit, just from the perspective of, for people like myself, whose legs sink, all of a sudden I could swim with a faster guy because I've got this flotation device on. And also, for people who were scared or worried and couldn't handle cold water, the wetsuit changed everything. You look at it the same way?
Well, the wetsuit, Dan Enfield,
yep,
you know, did the wetsuit introduction in the 80s, I believe, right?
87, yeah. My first edition of Competitor Magazine, he ran his first ad. He was actually a writer for me. And he said, hey, I want to do a thing on these swimming wetsuit material. And the article is called Rubber Barons. And we ran it in the first issue of Competitor. We had an ad for Quintana Roo on the inside front cover. I think he sold 300 wetsuits within the first few weeks.
Interesting, huh?
Yeah.
You know, we'll sidebar if you want at some point. But I actually ran ads in your magazine at the end of the 80s.
I love that. Thank you very much.
Which I'll tell you about. But Dan was smart in what he did. It was needed, and I think that's one of the things that helped, the pieces of equipment that helped evolve the sport and bring in some benefit. I mean, to some point, sort of bucket list people who want it's on their bucket list to do a triathlon, and the wetsuit would obviously give them the opportunity. But it just created a massive amount of exposure to the common person that could come in and get a wetsuit on and at least be able to complete the swim. So from that perspective, huge benefit to triathlon, and something that I'm completely in favor of. In fact, I think it was 1991 or 92, I brought Dan to I used to be heavily involved in, on the, not heavily, but quite a bit involved in the administrative end of U.S. Masters Swimming,
sure,
and USA Swimming. And I took Dan into a USA Swimming open water meeting, okay? Not even Masters, USA Swimming open water meeting to talk about wetsuits, because I believe this is going to be the future also for swimming.
Yeah.
And they almost kicked us out.
I bet they did. Yeah, they're like, wait a second, what? Wetsuit? Wait, that's for surfers. Said, get out
of
here.
You're heretics. What are you talking about? And fast forward, I believe that was around 1992. The convention was in Los Angeles. And where are we today? 2016. So that is, what, 24 years ago?
Yep.
Do you know it took 24 years? This year, last month, FINA, the International Governing Body of Swimming, has approved wetsuits for swimming.
You know what's so funny about that, Jerry, is I look at the individual sports, swimming, cycling, and running. Individually, I think a lot of those groups are very short-sighted.
Absolutely.
I think when you come into the world of triathlon, usually you come in with one skill, maybe two, but you're wide open to any product or any innovation that can help you in those other products that you're not, other disciplines that you're not confident in. And so our guys are, you know, I'm sure you find it. The triathletes are, they're open and they're sponges for anything on how to swim faster.
You're absolutely right. And I think part of it may not necessarily be, I said, agreement with absolutely in the sense that they're short-sighted. I think when we all tend to get caught up in our own horse blinders,
yes,
at times in whatever,
yep,
we're doing. So when you're in the swimming world, you just see what you've known. When you're in the riding world, you just see what you've known. When you're in the running world, you just see what you've known. It took triathlon to get Greg LeMond to put on some bars at the Tour, right?
Yep, absolutely.
It took triathlon to make that happen. It took triathlon to get wetsuits and swimming. It's triathlon is this bridge that is actually helping, I think, all three of those sports evolve tremendously.
No question about it.
From an economic standpoint, from an equipment perspective, from an entree into the sport by bringing people in. Triathlon's been just a wonderful, wonderful new sport that's created terrific experiences for many.
So as a coach who's been coaching since the 80s, how has swimming changed? How has coaching changed in the last, 30 years?
Well, I think there's two types of swimming coaching. Well, there's probably multiple. We can break it into different buckets in each category. But you've got coaching swimming to swimmers, and then you have coaching swimming to triathletes. And those are two very different things. Well, I think they're extremely different. I think there's some coaches who want to claim that they're not different, and I think those are the very naive coaches or the ones who haven't evolved yet to recognize the difference in demands. If you just start with the swimming bucket alone, that group, I think many training protocols have evolved in the 70s. There was, swimming went through the same evolution and revolution, too, of running, where there was massive amount of mileage.
Yep.
Remember the boom,
oh, yeah,
of running in the 70s?
LSD running, long, slow distance.
So swimming went the same way. I mean, the Mark Spitz era and before, they swam reasonable volume, but it was from 1973 where volume in swimming just skyrocketed. It's where the 100-100s became a standard for the distance swimmer.
Oh, my
and
God.
If you could do them in a minute, you were a god. And that started in
without your shoulders falling off.
Right. So they went through this period of almost 20 years of this incredible volume, 100,000 meters a week of swimming.
Oh, my God.
And that was sort of the normal training. That was sort of your stamp, your pedigree, that you made it. And when you think about this, Bob, think about it. 85% of swimming races are 2 minutes and shorter.
Wow.
Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
2 minutes and shorter. And 95% of them are 4 minutes and shorter. But you're swimming 70 miles a week?
I know. It's silly.
It's more than most people run a week.
Well, and running is the same thing. They pile 100 miles a week on these high school kids who are running a 1,500 meter on the track or maybe a 5K on the trails in cross country. It's just, it's silly to me. I don't, and it all does is burn people out.
So that was a big part of the training. And, you know, coaches were learning. That's what was going on at that time. It was new. And that type of training created pretty huge developments in swimming. So what's evolved since then is obviously much more specificities come in. There are lots of smart coaches that now have degrees in exercise physiology and so on. And that's helped the swimming end of it evolve into more acute doses to the specific individuals. It's very rare to find what we had back in the 70s where a swimmer could swim multiple events and do really well in. Now you're a specialist in every single event, for the most part, specialist at every distance, specialist in the 50 freestyle versus the 200 freestyle and so on. So that's sort of the swimming arena. In the triathlon space, I think it took, at least as I saw it, there were really no coaches that were too interested in the triathlon space because they just sort of looked at these triathletes as, well, we don't have time for you guys.
You're generalists, right? You're half decent at three different things.
You come in, you clog up our workouts, you want to wear your pull buoys all the time. You don't really want to do what we tell you to do. You start crying when we ask you to do butterfly. Well, whatever it is, there was sort of the feel of the thing of most coaches back then. And then I think Terry Laughlin from Total Immersion came in and did a pretty good job at sort of harvesting this group of triathletes and creating a sort of an easy 1-2-3 step pattern of how to swim and or how to teach swimming to triathletes. And that sort of helped swimming for the triathlete move forward. And then the next big step came, as I see it, in 2000 when in the U.S. alone, we had 20,000 registered triathletes. And all of a sudden, after 2000, if you fast forward to now, you're in the hundreds of thousands of registered triathletes. So the 2000 introduction to the Olympics was just a big opening of the sport that made coaches go, wait a minute, it's not an Olympic sport.
Yes, it is.
All right, yeah. I'm interested. Yeah. Okay.
I know. Now I'm interested because there's rings attached to it.
Exactly.
And then, obviously, when Ironman has, 41 full Ironmans around the world and 93 or something, Ironman 70.3s, that makes people sit up and take notice, too, because that's a big volume of people who are training for this stuff.
And not to forget, obviously, the economic side of it.
Absolutely. Yep.
Although there are many coaches, many thousands that make a living in swimming, here was another way to make some extra money for some of them. Because the demographic of the sport of triathletes is reasonably high. You're in line with tennis and golf and so on. So it's more disposable income, and folks were willing to pay for the services of good coaches.
Sure. So in terms of what you're doing now, are you coaching every day? Do you primarily coach open water, pool? What's the breakdown for you on a weekly basis?
So I coach daily, except Sundays.
Uh-huh.
And I would say 95%, 99% triathletes. Completely.
Wow.
Yeah. It was where I started. Mm-hmm. And then I coached some elite athletes for a while, coached a bunch of masters swimming for a long, long time. But I was always super attracted to the triathlete for one specific reason. It always gave me a way to measure my performance as a coach. Because your average master swimmer, only 20% or less of them compete.
That's true.
So, see, you never really got a sense of, well, to validate what you're doing.
Exactly.
And to say, you can call yourself a good coach, but how do you know?
That's a really good point. But most people who are training for triathlon are training for a triathlon or multiple triathlons.
They're doing an event.
Right.
Every triathlete is a racer.
Right.
So ultimately, every triathlete you coach is going to go to an event, with most of them obviously being in open water, a couple in the pool, but the great bandwidth is open water. And they're going to put themselves on the line, and then you're going to get a measure as to how you were as a coach. How did you do for that athlete? So that was super appealing to me and completely evolved into, after I got out of the magazine business, into coaching mainly triathletes and now exclusively triathletes. So we run a full menu of swim workouts, several a day for triathletes in Pacific Palisades. And then we run one workout, one very organized workout, and then some other offshoots for the pros, but one organized workout a week from April through October, open water. and it's interesting, Bob, it's on a Wednesday morning before work. There are 200 people that show up to it.
And that's Tower 26?
And that's at Tower 26 in Santa Monica. And it's a highly structured, very organized, tight, well-executed session where, you know, all these folks are broken into different categories of speed and whoever the names are in the professional ranks, whenever they're in town, they're always coming and swimming out workouts.
How fun is that? That's so cool. And biggest challenge for you, because I remember working with some of our swim coaches down here and bringing them new triathletes who had never been in a pool, never swam in their life. And, they would look, invariably they'd look at me and be like, yeah, thanks for this. That's great. Guys 5'6" with really heavy legs, and I'm supposed to get them to the Ironman in 6 months. That's great. What's the biggest challenge you faced with somebody who came in with absolutely no swimming background and said, oh, by the way, I'm doing Ironman in a month?
I think there are a couple of challenges. That in itself is one of them, where they come in a month before, and this is the case with the Malibu Triathlon. Three weeks before, I'm doing the Malibu Triathlon, they call up and I say, perfect, I'll take you on for next year.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Because that's just insane to do that. But I think on the broader scope of the answer, it's similar to, and remove politics for a moment, it has nothing to do with this. I just watched a movie on Ben Carson, the gentleman that's running for office.
Yeah.
The Ben Carson story. I didn't know much about the guy. It's one of the most incredible movies I've seen, but he talked about why he likes being a brain surgeon. And he loves the challenge of being able to solve very acute issues that hadn't been done before, that are complex, that you really have to sit and think about it and figure out and see if you can do it. Well, there's a carryover for that after you coach pretty decent athletes for a while, and then you have to come in and solve these problems of triathletes that are not indigenous to swimmers, such as super stiff ankles, highly immobile hips, incredibly inflexible shoulders, and a lot of it as a byproduct of running long miles, because running is super corrosive, as you know, and the body just tightens up over time. So you got to sort of figure out, okay, we can teach them. Now, how do we teach them to get the best return on time investment?
Yes.
Which is sort of what this podcast series I have is about. But it's how do we take that person and just go, okay, now you only got 2 or 3 hours a week. What's the right dosage of technique versus training? And that's where, for me, the where I like tinkering, so to speak.
Love that. So talk a little bit about your podcast. That's a fairly new endeavor for you.
Well, it's a new, I wouldn't even call it an endeavor, because there's no income associated with it. It's Jim Levinsky, who has his own podcast, has been swam with us on and off over the years, and had invited me to be on his show a couple of times, and for one reason or the other, it hadn't worked out. And just last year, we were talking about it again, and he said, we should find a way to do some sort of podcast thing together. And, it's one of those seeds that got planted. And I thought about it, and I said, 2016, how about we launch just an educational podcast series on triathlon swimming?
Love that.
And he thought about it. He goes, do you think it'll go? I said, I don't know, but here's what I do know. Out of the three sports, it's the one that's with the biggest puzzle to it.
No question.
It's the one that, although it's only 10% of the time demand of a half Ironman or an Ironman, or 17% of the time demand, race time demand of an Olympic distance, it is almost 100% of the anxiety, okay?
130%,
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So there's massive anxiety, there's a lot of underpreparedness, and it's the most puzzling one. And there's still not a lot of coaching in sport. If you look at the sport of triathlon, if you look at the makeup, most triathletes still aren't coached.
Right.
And then you have the great majority aren't. And then of the ones who are, some may just go to a master's workout, and that may not be the right dosage or the right prescription, because they're training for master's nationals as opposed to an open water event. So some programs are better than others, but some may not be the right one. And then you have athletes who are coached by triathlon coaches, and some of them listen to their coaches and others don't. So what you really have are a whole lot of triathletes who don't know much about swimming, and I think there's a need for good education. So I said, you know what, I've been doing this for 32 years. I think I've tinkered around enough to have some credibility to be able to provide that education. I've had tremendous success in the triathlon space with people improving 10 to 20% in their first year. Let's put it out there. Let's just give it away.
Love it. And you know what's interesting, I tell people this all the time. If you and I are going for a bike ride and I get tired, we can stop. If we're
right.
running and I get tired, we can stop. If we swim and I get tired, I die. That's a problem, right? That makes that there's a little more urgency to making sure that you're comfortable in any type of swimming environment. That's why I've always been this huge proponent for the pool triathlon, where you run a 5K first and it's a 10-mile bike, and then it's like 200 yards in a pool where the water's warm, where there's a lane lines, where there's lifeguards, where there's walls, right? Then there's security. That gets people in, and then they can go and try something a little open water where there's obviously more at stake when you're out there in open water.
Agreed. Basically, what you're saying in summary is there's a safety element.
Absolutely.
And,
huge.
And so how do we manage the safety? And you just gave one example of, well, let's get them introduced into pool triathlons first, and then
to
we can graduate.
Yeah.
Yeah, and graduate from the kiddie pool to the big pool, so to speak.
Exactly.
So it's safety is a big, and ultimately, if you go through a proper training protocol, and I don't mean you have to be like a professional swimming 5 to 8 times a week and 5 to 12 hours a week of swimming. No, 2 times a week, 3 times a week, maybe 2 to 3 hours. If you do it and follow a certain regime in a particular format, that takes care of safety.
No question about it. So how can people find the podcast?
Oh, it's on our website, tower26.com, but it's also on iTunes.
Love it.
And, I wish I had the proper answer, but there are a couple
of
places.
No, that's it. If they go to towers26.com, and if they go to iTunes, they'll find it.
Right, they can go to iTunes and search it out also. And they're short. What I've done with these, Jim and I have, they're all under 30 minutes.
Love it.
My goal with this is to keep it crisp.
Yes.
And, hey, you know what? You can listen to this on your way home from work.
Exactly. That's perfect, Jerry. Congratulations on that.
Thank you, sir.
I appreciate that. And for a young guy who started swimming in Trinidad, way back in the day, and listening to Mark Spitz at 3 a.m. over in Munich, you certainly have taken this sport and made a great living out of it. It's wonderful, and more important, you love what you do.
I'm lucky in the sense I found something that I enjoy doing, and I started putting on. I did some races for a while, which is when we bought some advertising from you guys back in the 80s. In fact, it's when I met Lewis Schwartz.
Lewis, my partner, yes.
Yes, she was
the best.
She shot me at I won the La Jolla Roughwater Swim a bunch of times. And
yep.
So she was taking lots of photographs, and that's how we met. And then we did some events that I put on in 90 and 91 and 92 and bought advertising from you guys. And then you and I were competitors for a while. I don't know if you knew that. But,
no.
Yes.
You had to be crunching me on a daily basis.
No, not at all. I was the publisher, co-publisher of Swimming World, Swimming Technique, and Swim Magazine. And that's when Fitness Swimmer got launched. And eventually, after a year or two, they hired you guys.
Right.
To be the ad rep firm for them.
Yes, we did. We sold. It was one of those things when Rodeo launched Fitness Swimmer. It was really because Heidi Rodale's husband at the time was a master swimmer. I think that's the only reason they did.
One of the reasons,
yeah. And I felt that, okay, two things are going to happen here. One, the magazine is going to be successful. And if it is, they're not going to continue to use a sales group out of Southern California. They'll bring it in-house.
Yes.
Or two, it's not going to be successful, and they'll close it. So either way, we're going to be out. So we're like, hey, thank you so much for hiring us. We'll do this for as long as possible. And, eventually we know we're going to go away, so we'll enjoy every second of it until we do.
Well, I thought it was a super smart move on you guys' part because Rodale owns many magazines.
Exactly.
You get your foot in the door with one of them. Before you know it, you get two, three, and then you're selling ads by in an aggregate rather than just for one vertical.
Exactly.
But
well, that's what it is. And the worst that could have happened was, oh, gosh, maybe we should buy a competitor. So, you know, there was a lot of positive reasons for us to take that on. Plus, you know, from a sales perspective, our sales reps were already dealing with most of the swimming guys. And as you found out, there's not a lot of swimming advertising out there. Right.
Perfect.
You've got nutrition and then you've got Speedo, Tier, and whoever has the latest workout equipment. But the problem I always felt with swimming is you have running events and you have triathlon events and people see the masses out there. People don't see the masses who are in the pools every day. And so the advertising, Madison Avenue, doesn't look at that as a demographic to reach those guys except around the Olympics.
Right. Well, it's interesting because swimming is extremely centralized, whereas running is more decentralized, and so is triathlon.
Yep.
You know, you look at competitive swimming, you've got 7,000 or 8,000 or more age group teams. You've got a couple of thousand masters teams. Well, you know, you've got over 10,000 clubs.
Right.
You don't have that in triathlon.
No.
Every swimmer has a coach. So it's extremely centralized. It's easy to target. And the age demographic is actually a little bit younger. And then, to your point earlier on, that you stated about maybe swimming coaches being myopic or
right,
staying in their space, there still hasn't been. There's a little bit more now, but there still hasn't been an innovation of product.
Nothing.
For swimming.
No.
So therefore, back to your point of being able to sell advertising, you didn't have much to sell.
Nothing. I know. And nobody was convinced that the swimmers needed nutrition. The nutrition guys would look at us cross-eyed and we say, you know what, these people are in the pool an hour a day, 5 days a week. They need nutrition. And I was like, they're going to get out of the pool and they're going to go to breakfast.
Or they don't sweat.
Right. They're in the water. You don't see
them. That we sweat.
Exactly. I know, Jerry. It was really, I mean, I could count on one hand the amount of swimming-specific advertising we had in competitor in our, you know, in the 27 years I was there. It was always a challenge, right? Until wetsuits, there really wasn't a lot of reason for swimming guys to be advertising, and then all of a sudden the wetsuit was a huge deal, and it's interesting that swimming didn't adopt that, because that was a lot of dollars in wetsuits.
Well, they're going to now, and I suspect over the next 5 years we will see over a dozen new equipment products for triathlon swimmers.
Love it. That's cool. Hey, Jerry, thanks so much for taking time. Congratulations on everything you're doing. Tower26.com, the best place to send people to find out everything you're doing?
Yes. Thank you so much, Bob. I appreciate your time. You're a busy man.
Anytime. Okay, anytime. Jerry Rodriguez, one of the very best in the business. We are brought to you by Ironman U, by EveryPsych.com, RunCatalina.com, our Challenge Athletes Foundation. We've raised over $70 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on iTunes or on Babbittville, and our new newsletter, Endurance World, Bob Babbitt's Endurance World. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.